According to the CDC, 6 out of 10 American adults are living with a chronic illness. For those Americans, the pandemic has been particularly challenging and terrifying, especially since so many of those with chronic illnesses are also immunocompromised. And some health experts fear some of those who contracted COVID-19 may have long-term issues. Our next guest is one of those Americans living with chronic illness. Writer and science reporter Tessa Miller was a 20-something New Yorker when she was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, a chronic digestive illness. Her life changed drastically, not just in terms of medical bills and extended leaves from work. The illness at times threatened Tessa's life. Tessa writes of one of her lowest points. "I now weighed 90 pounds. My skin appeared alien gray and hung from my bones like a saggy deflated balloon. I relied on someone else for everything, sitting up, putting rubber bottom socks on, going to the bathroom, washing up in my room's tiny shower. My body didn't feel like my own. I was ordered not to eat anything, but wouldn't have wanted to anyway. Fluids and nutrition came intravenously, though IVs got harder and harder to insert due to all the blown veins. Giant bruises covered my arms in spindly purple and green fireworks next to sore, scabby rashes from all the weeks of medical tape. My veins became so difficult to find that they had to use a machine called a vein viewer on my arms, legs, and neck to locate deeper locations less likely to blow up. I left IVs in longer than I should have for fear of not finding another usable spot. I'm not certain why they didn't insert a port. My blood pressure was 70 over 50 on a good day, and some days it wouldn't register at all." Tessa has written a book about living with Crohn's disease. It's titled, "What Doesn't Kill You, A Life with Chronic Illness, Lessons from a Body in Revolt." Tessa shares that she wrote the book because, quote, "I needed a book written by someone who exists in that foggy space between the common cold and terminal cancer, where illness doesn't go away, but won't kill you." Tessa Miller joins me now. Tessa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much for having me.
And if you are listening and listening with chronic illness, we'd like you to join this conversation. What's something you wish more people knew about the experience? And we know that the pandemic and social distancing has been particularly difficult and frightening for people, especially those with chronic illness. What's been the past year been like for you? What's something that's gotten you through? Give us a call at 646-435-7280. Of course, this is a judgment-free zone, so don't fear calling in. 646-435-7280.
I'm really excited to hear from people. I'm hopeful that maybe some people from my own community will call in, because I told them I would be on today, and so I might hear a familiar name. Which is exciting. But yeah, I'm excited to hear from people. This is going to be great.
Yeah, that often happens. I want to talk about the structure of the book a little bit, talk about your writing as well as your experience. So it's part memoir. It's a little bit of a guidebook for those living with chronic illness. It's also a guidebook for people who haven't and maybe don't completely understand and want to understand. Why did you want to structure it this way rather than going straight memoir?
That's a great question. Well, when I was in my initial talks with my publisher and with my editor at Macmillan, this was a question that came up over and over and over again, because I really didn't want it to be straight memoir, because what I kept thinking was, I need this to be the book that I wish someone had handed me when I first got diagnosed. And there was some practical stuff that I needed to know, on top of just reading someone's memoir and being able to feel like I wasn't alone. I also needed practical stuff like how to find a good doctor, how to find a good therapist, what happens if I lose my job and I need to find health insurance. There was all this stuff that I had to learn in real time over the last 10 years of being sick. And so we kept talking about, okay, do we make the first half of the book your memoir? And then maybe the second half of the book is all this service journalism. Because I also used to work at Lifehacker, which is sort of the infamous service journalism website. And I wanted to bring in these skills too, to really help people be able to take actionable steps when they read the book. which I feel are just as important as the memoir part of the book, which makes you feel like that me as a writer understands what you're going through. So getting the two parts of the book right was really the biggest challenge that we faced. We ended up kind of messing around with it in three different forms. It ended up in the form that it is now, which I kind of call choose your own adventure, because you can read about my life if you want to. That's at the beginning of most of the chapters. Most of the kind of servicey stuff is in the second half of the chapters. And then the book also has this wonderful index and appendices in the back as well. So it's sort of a reference book as well.
The book, for people who pick it up, it can be graphic at times. You describe failing bodily functions, hospital procedures, your own body even. Yeah. Why did you decide to write this way, and were you comfortable with it?
I had never read a book about my own illness that didn't use euphemisms for bodily functions. And I read some of those books when I first got diagnosed, and then compared to what my body was actually doing, that just didn't line up at all. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't poetic. It wasn't a euphemism. I wanted to write about my body in an honest way. I wanted to write about it in a scientifically accurate way. And I think that people from my community who I leaned on a lot as I was writing this book and asking them, you know, are you guys okay with people who don't have our illness reading about it in this way? And what they said to me was yes, because I feel like part of the reason people don't understand our illness is because they don't actually know what happens to our bodies because of it. And so I wanted to be really clear about the gnarly stuff that Crohn's disease does to the body. And I wasn't going to sugarcoat it. I didn't think that that served my community or the reader. I also wasn't trying to be overly graphic for any dramatic effect. I was just trying to be honest about what my body does and what this disease does to the body. Was it scary to write that way? Absolutely. I'm a 32-year-old woman. I don't want to write about how I lose control of my bowels and all of the stuff that's in the book, but I think that it's necessary for people to understand the reality of an illness like mine.
When was the first time that you really realized you weren't dealing with an allergy or a stomach bug? Mm-hmm. Or I mean, you always knew something was wrong, but that moment when you really faced up to it and said, okay, this is serious.
Yeah, I kind of start the book off from that point. I had mystery illnesses throughout childhood, and I describe those in the book. I had colic as a baby. When I was in fourth or fifth grade, I was out of school for at least a month, going to the children's hospital and getting some tests and stuff, and all of that was inconclusive. And then in college, again, I had another sort of month-long mystery illness that no one could diagnose me with anything. So I have a feeling that I've had either, well, I have Crohn's disease and I have celiac disease. And I'm pretty certain that I've had one or both of those for most of my life, but they were just never properly diagnosed. The first time that I really, really knew something was wrong was when I came home for a Thanksgiving. It was my first year out of college. I was living in New York and interning at Wired Magazine. And I came home, and when I would go to the bathroom, not to be too graphic on the radio, but I was passing nothing but blood. Mm-hmm. And tons and tons and tons of it. And that was when I knew something was really wrong, because I didn't know where it was coming from. I couldn't stop it, and it just kept increasing, along with a lot of pain, a lot of weakness, and some other symptoms like sores in my mouth and all of this stuff that I hadn't experienced before. I was used to stomach aches and that kind of thing, and for a long, long time, from elementary school on, you know, I was labeled, oh, she's just a nervous kid. She's got a right. nervous stomach, which is something that I've heard a lot from fellow chronically ill people. But it was about, I was about 23 when it really got bad enough to the point where I had to seek serious medical intervention.
My guest is Tessa Miller. The name of her book is What Doesn't Kill You, A Life with Chronic Illness, Lessons from a Body in Revolt. Let's take a couple of calls, Tessa. Sam on line mm-hmm. one has been holding. Hi, Sam. Thanks for calling in. Sam, you're
Hello.
On the air. Hi.
Hi.
So how have things been for you during COVID? I see that you have diabetes.
Well, I called in. I do have diabetes, but that's not the reason I called in. That's a chronic illness, but mm-hmm. the reason I called in was because I've been dealing with bipolar mm-hmm. for a lot longer. Mm-hmm. I'm in my 60s, and I was diagnosed 40 years ago. So I've been living with this all this time. And during the pandemic, it's difficult for a lot of reasons, you know, fairly obvious. It's well documented, whatever. But the thing that, listening to this young woman makes me realize that, you know, having common, I guess, with all anybody with a chronic illness is trying to make other people aware of exactly what it is. I think a lot of misconceptions, and also trying to find help. Mm-hmm. Like in general, it's very difficult especially, you know, if you get suicidal, which I've been, and you mm-hmm. know, so while here call the suicide hotline or calling in for help, what ends up happening is you get a lot of questioning, mm-hmm. questions.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly the most mm-hmm. helpful thing. And also the to find treatment, just the whole process of finding treatment, trying to figure out what's going on, can be very difficult if you're doing it on your own.
Right.
And like, mm-hmm. Talking about having a community to help is very helpful. And that mm-hmm. gets kind of blown out of the water during the pandemic. But just in general, yeah. besides that, just to have even family members, other people to understand, you know, an old guy like me trying to go on websites and navigate their way. Even right now, trying to get a COVID vaccine is ridiculous.
Yeah. Sam, thank you for calling in, and please do reach out if you find yourself in distress. One of the things I want to point out also, Tessa, in your book is you really do talk quite a bit about therapy and support.
Yeah. I could have written the entire book about chronic physical illness and mental health. That's sort of the thesis of the book, I guess, mm-hmm. if I had to pick one thing. And the thing that I'm most hopeful for my chronically ill reader to take away is that your body and your brain, they aren't two separate entities. They're a very intimately connected partnership. And when I talk to folks in my chronic illness support groups, or when I talk to chronically ill people through my journalism work, they have a pretty easy time understanding their physical symptoms. and why those are happening. But what they have a harder time understanding is why they feel so anxious or depressed, or why they have symptoms of PTSD. And I think that mental health care should be so automatically built into the care plan for people with chronic physical illnesses like mine, because depression and anxiety, I would say, are not only likely to happen, I would say they are common to be expected symptoms of long-term illness. And I wish that when a chronic illness patient went to a doctor for physical symptoms, that they also had a conversation about the mental health side of things and left with a referral for mm-hmm. someone who would be on their care team as someone to take care of the mental health side of this stuff. Like Sam said, mm-hmm. it can be extremely difficult to find good mental health help. It takes a lot of legwork, and it's dependent on what kind of health insurance you have. And it just is, it's hard to seek out mental health care when you're already dealing with the symptoms of chronic illness, when you're fatigued and you're in pain. And the last thing you want to do is start researching for mental health help, mm-hmm. Which is why I think community and having an advocate is so important, someone that you can call on to help you with this kind of stuff. Community is just such an essential part of living with chronic illness, and I think we'll probably talk about that a little mm-hmm. more as we get into this conversation. But I'm thankful for Sam for calling in.
Let's go to Eli on line 4, who's been holding. Hi, Eli. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. In August, I was diagnosed with chronic myeloid leukemia, and my doctor told me the bad news was I have leukemia, and the good news was that it's a treatable form. And I have been responding well to treatment, and I feel so fortunate. I know that there are a lot of people with this disease that are not in the position that I am. But I wanted to share the experience of, and now that I'm about 4 months in with my TKI treatment, which brings my numbers to the place where they need to be. I go through phases of returning to life as normal, almost forgetting that I even have cancer. And then either I'll get, you know, a folliculitis, which could happen to anyone, a rash mm-hmm. on the skin, or I have a doctor's appointment coming up, and all of a sudden, all of the thoughts associated with the diagnosis and all of the scary thoughts, they come crashing in all at once, and that mm-hmm. whiplash itself is scary and so unsettling and like a little mini earthquake kind of every time it happens. Mm-hmm. So I don't mm-hmm. know entirely if that'll ever go away, because I have a doctor's visit every 3 months for probably the rest of my life.
First of all, Eli, thank you for being so candid and sharing your story. Is there anything yeah. that you heard in Eli's story, Tessa, that you think you could offer yes. him some guidance?
Yes, Eli, I write about this feeling so much in the book. I have a chronic illness that works in patterns of flare-ups and remissions. And like you said, when I reach a point of remission, I do have that same feeling where it's like, oh, I'm quote unquote normal again. And, you know, then inevitably I have a flare up again, or I have to go to the doctor, or I end up in the hospital or whatever. And it's constantly re-traumatizing. I also, hear in your story that you think a lot in the way that I think, in that I catastrophize everything, which I think is common for people who've been dealt a serious diagnosis. your brain goes to the place where it was the worst. And that sounds to me like medical PTSD, which is something that I write about in the book and is incredibly common among people who have been diagnosed with cancer. It's common among people who have bowel diseases like mine that are unpredictable, heart attack survivors, people who've had strokes. It's a challenging version of PTSD because in quote unquote normal PTSD, the triggers are usually external and often they're in the past. And so when you go to therapy for this kind of PTSD, you focus on safety in the present moment and distance from the trauma that happened. But when you're chronically ill, a lot of those triggers are internal inside your body. Like you said, I got folliculitis, which isn't that big of a deal, but it really made me freak out. And so that kind of stuff has happened to me before in the past too. And so the PTSD that comes with chronic illness is tricky because it's this lifetime of triggers that come and go. And the treatment for it has to be a little bit different than it would be for quote unquote regular PTSD. But I want to remind you that there are mental health professionals who are very well versed in health psychology and in medical PTSD, and that kind of PTSD you can learn to healthily cope with it, and you won't always be stuck in these cycles of catastrophizing.
My guest is Tessa Miller. The name of her book is What Doesn't Kill You, A Life with Chronic Illness, Lessons from a Body in Revolt. We need to take a quick break. And after the break, we have a very specific question for you, Tessa, from a woman calling in from Los Angeles. We'll get to Audrey after the break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Tessa Miller. Her book is called What Doesn't Kill You, A Life with Chronic Illness, Lessons from a Body in Revolt. Tessa, you write in your book, forever sickness, I would learn, changes more than bones and blood. It changes goals, careers, intimate relationships, families, and dreams. What was one of the more difficult life adjustments for you to accept? And what was one that was easier than you imagined?
One that was difficult for me was that I didn't have to give up my journalism career entirely, but I had to change the way it looked a lot. I could no longer work in a fast-paced, always on newsroom. I had to transition to freelance and work from home and kind of start over that way. But more so than that, I had really built a lot of my self-worth around my success in my career. And when that looked different, I had to ask myself all these questions. You know, who am I without this career that I've been working towards my entire life? And without this job as the central thing in my life, what do I like? What are my interests? How will other people see me? Who am I? It was all these really big, you know, these big questions, and evaluating that kind of stuff can be really painful. So that was difficult for me, especially as a sort of type A perfectionist who really used to place a lot of value in if it looked like I was doing well, then I was doing well, even if I wasn't. So that was difficult and painful for me to really, reevaluate who I was without this stuff to define me. Something that was easier, was, I kind of describe this as how chronic illness presents, a fork in the road in the way that you talk to yourself, mm-hmm. how you spend time in your brain with your self dialogue. And, it gives you this chance to choose, do you want your brain to be this horrid, abusive place to spend all your time where you're spewing stuff at yourself that you're worthless and disgusting and unlovable and shameful? Or do you want it to be this kinder, more loving place? And I got to this point where it was like, I'm stuck with me. I'm stuck with this dialogue. I'm stuck with this incurable illness. And I spent a lot of time going down that venomous, toxic road. And I had to work really hard to turn that around and kind of go the other way. I had to forgive myself for not being the person that I imagined myself being. But that was okay, because in a lot of ways, I was a better version. Mm-hmm. I was kinder. I was more empathetic. I was much more dedicated to my community and to disability justice. And I started to see myself through this kinder lens that for a long time didn't come naturally to me at all. But in a strange way, chronic illness sort of gifted that to me. And yeah, I have to keep practicing it. Sure. All the time. But that's really been a gift that it's given me.
Let's go to Audrey, who's called in from Los Angeles. Hi, Audrey. Thanks for holding. You're on the air with Tessa Miller.
Hi, Tessa. I'm wondering if you could speak about your experience navigating the pandemic as an immunocompromised young person. I have ulcerative colitis, and I've really related and empathized really hard with a lot of the experiences you're describing. And I found that during this time, I often have to remind people that I don't, like, quote unquote, look sick, but I am more vulnerable to COVID, and I don't feel comfortable doing things like outdoor dining. So I'd love to hear about your experience during this time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most difficult part for me, it has been trying not to internalize these conversations, mostly among politicians, about the value of chronically ill and disabled lives. Some of that conversation has been very loud over the last year, and it's hard for me and for my community to hear that and feel like we are worthy human beings in this world who deserve to be here. And so that's been something that's been challenging for me during the pandemic. I've been sick for 10 years, and so I've gotten pretty comfortable telling people that I can't do stuff because I'm immunocompromised. And I also have written a lot about it, and it's part of sort of this public-facing self through my work. So a lot of people are already very respectful of that, thankfully, even before the pandemic happened. But yeah, the whole thing about, oh, you don't look sick because your illness is mostly invisible. I think it just takes having a conversation about what your disease is, what it means to be immunocompromised. I find that sometimes when people get even just a little bit of education about what our diseases are and how our medications affect us, that they're usually pretty understanding about it. And if they aren't, then F them.
My guest is Tessa Miller. The name of her book is What Doesn't Kill You, A Life with Chronic Illness, Lessons from a Body in Revolt. Let's go to Prescott calling in from Bloomfield, New Jersey. Hi, Prescott. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you. Thank you for a thoughtful radio, as always. And thank you, Ms. Miller. I look forward to reading the book. So two thoughts. So I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I was diagnosed about 13 years ago. And and it's just a condition that I've learned to really work hard at trying to manage. And, of course, it affects me day to day and, you know, low sugars and high sugars and the thinking about the importance of managing for the sake of my future. And then when the pandemic hits, I know this isn't exactly what was being said, but it felt like everything on the news when the science was still ambiguous was saying, you're going to be okay unless you have diabetes. You're going to be okay unless you're And I found my, myself in those moments catastrophizing, which is a word that you used and I heard for the first time earlier, for the first time. And so what happened is for the first time in my life, it changed my relationship. The pandemic was changing my relationship, not just with society, but also with the disease.
Of course.
I don't like it.
And
I don't want to do that, right?
So let me you know what? I want to dive in here, Prescott. Thank you so much for calling in because we're going to run out of time. I'm really glad you shared your story. I did want to ask this one final question of you, Tessa, which is for people who want to help, can you just give us one thing that we can do or say that is helpful and one thing that really isn't in about a minute and a half?
Sure. The thing that you don't want to do is to try to fix it. Don't swoop in and try to fix it because you can't. Don't give unsolicited advice. We have heard it all. We have tried it all. We are doing what we can, what we know is best for us and with the help of our doctors. So please do not try to give us unsolicited advice right now, especially during a pandemic. The thing that you can do is say, I believe you. I love you. I got a book about your illness and I'm learning more about it because I want to be as educated and supportive as I can. And I'm here to help you in a real true way, or just tell them how you're going to help them rather than leaving it open-ended. We need people to believe us. We need people to listen. And we don't need people to keep trying to fix us.
The name of the book is What Doesn't Kill You, A Life with Chronic Illness, Lessons from a Body in Revolt by Tessa Miller. Tessa, thank you so much for being with us and for listening and helping out our listeners.
Thank you, Allison. This was a real thrill for me.